Hi, I'm Dennis O'Hare. In my career, I've been cast as a vampire, a cannibal, a serial killer, and various other creepy guys you'd cross the street to get away from. Now that I think about it, why is that? What is it about me that has my agent sending me out for these parts? I think I'm a nice guy. I help old ladies across the street. I even said yes when Selected Shorts asked me to thank their podcast sponsor, Zabars, and Zabars.com. Zabars and Zabars.com sell over 8,000 pounds of freshly roasted coffee each week and also have New York toasting bagels, smoked salmon, caviar, and babka. And Zabars delivers throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Listeners can find out about exclusive offers and free shipping and can get a free story download at Zabars.com/shorts. See there? Only a really nice guy would do something so selfless.
My father tells of his plans for the future, and my mother shows with expressive face how interested she is and how impressed. My father becomes exultant. He is lifted up by the waltz that is being played, and his own future begins to intoxicate him.
This week on Selected Shorts, Fateful Courtships.
I believe the gypsy in him finally got the upper hand. And it led to such a remarkable happening that no one in the family has so far been willing to admit it. Not the obvious transgression that he had run away to join the circus, but that he was in all likelihood a man who had been stolen by a horse.
I'm Jane Curtin, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. On this program, we have two stories in which adult children try to make sense of their family histories. The first is Delmore Schwartz's well-known piece, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, which was performed at the Getty Center in Los Angeles by Leonard Nimoy.
I think it is the year 1909. I feel as if I were in a motion picture theater, the long arm of light crossing the darkness and spinning, my eyes fixed on the screen. This is a silent picture, as if an old biograph, one in which the actors are dressed in ridiculously old-fashioned clothes, and one flash succeeds another with sudden jumps. The actors seem to jump about and walk too fast. The shots themselves are full of dots and rays, as if it were raining when the picture was photographed. The light is bad. It is Sunday afternoon, June 12th, 1909, and my father is walking down the quiet streets of Brooklyn on his way to visit my mother. His clothes are newly pressed and his tie is too tight in his high collar. He jingles the coins in his pockets, thinking of the witty things he will say. I feel as if I had by now relaxed entirely in the soft darkness of the theater. The organist peels out the obvious and approximate emotions on which the audience rocks unknowingly. I am anonymous, and I have forgotten myself. It is always so when one goes to the movies. It is, as they say, a drug. My father walks from street to street of trees, lawns, and houses, once in a while coming to an avenue on which a streetcar skates and gnaws, slowly progressing. The conductor, who has a handlebar mustache, helps a young lady wearing a hat like a bowl with feathers onto the car. She lifts her long skirts slightly as she mounts the steps. He leisurely makes change and rings his bell. It is obviously Sunday, for everyone is wearing Sunday clothes, and the streetcar's noises emphasize the quiet of the holiday. Is not Brooklyn the city of churches? The shops are closed and their shades drawn, but for an occasional stationery store, a drugstore with great green balls in the window. My father has chosen to take this long walk because he likes to walk and think. He thinks about himself in the future And so he arrives at the place he is to visit in a state of mild exaltation. He pays no attention to the houses that he's passing, in which the Sunday dinner is being eaten, nor to the many trees which patrol each street, now coming to their full leafage in the time when they will room the whole street in cool shadow. An occasional carriage passes, the horse's hooves falling like stones in the quiet afternoon, and once in a while, an automobile, looking like an enormous upholstered sofa, puffs and passes. My father thinks of my mother. How nice it will be to introduce her to his family. But he's not yet sure that he wants to marry her, and once in a while, he becomes panicky about the bond already established. He reassures himself by thinking of the big men he admires who are married. William Randolph Hearst and William Howard Taft, who has just become president of the United States. My father arrives at my mother's house. He has come too early and so is suddenly embarrassed. My aunt, my mother's sister, answers the loud bell with her napkin in her hand, for the family is still at dinner. As my father enters, my grandfather rises from the table and shakes hands with him. My mother has run upstairs to tidy herself. My grandmother asks my father if he's had dinner and tells him that Rose will be downstairs soon. My grandfather opens the conversation by remarking on the mild June weather. My father sits uncomfortably near the table, holding his hat in his hand. My grandmother tells my aunt to take my father's hat. My uncle, 12 years old, runs into the house, his hair tousled. He shouts a greeting to my father, who has often given him a nickel, and then he runs upstairs. It is evident that the respect in which my father is held in this household is tempered by a good deal of mirth. He is impressive, yet he is very awkward. Finally, my mother comes downstairs, all dressed up, and my father, being engaged in conversation with my grandfather, becomes uneasy, not knowing whether to greet my mother or continue the conversation. He gets up from the chair clumsily and says, "Hello," gruffly. My grandfather watches, examining their congruence, such as it is, with a critical eye, and meanwhile rubbing his bearded cheek roughly, as he always does when he reflects. He's worried. He's afraid that my father will not make a good husband for his oldest daughter. At this point, something happens to the film. Just as my father is saying something funny to my mother, I'm awakened to myself and my unhappiness just as my interest was rising. The audience begins to clap impatiently. Then the trouble is cared for, but the film has been returned to a portion just shown, and once more, I see my grandfather rubbing his bearded cheek and pondering my father's character. It is difficult to get back into the picture once more and forget myself, but as my mother giggles at my father's words, the darkness drowns me. My father and mother depart from the house, my father shaking hands with my mother once more out of some unknown uneasiness. I stir uneasily, also slouched in the hard chair of the theater. Where is the older uncle, my mother's older brother? He's studying in his bedroom upstairs, studying for his final examination at the College of the City of New York, having been dead of rapid pneumonia for the last 21 years. My mother and father walk down the same quiet streets once more. My mother is holding my father's arm and telling him of the novel which she's been reading, and my father utters judgments of the characters as the plot is made clear to him. This is a habit which he very much enjoys, for he feels the utmost superiority and confidence when he approves and condemns the behavior of other people. At times he feels moved to utter a brief "ugh" whenever the story becomes what he would call sugary. This tribute is paid to his manliness. My mother feels satisfied by the interest which she's awakened. She's showing my father how intelligent she is and how interesting. They reach the avenue. and the streetcar leisurely arrives. They're going to Coney Island this afternoon, although my mother considers that such pleasures are inferior. She's made up her mind to indulge only in a walk on the boardwalk and a pleasant dinner, avoiding the riotous amusements as being beneath the dignity of so dignified a couple. My father tells my mother how much money he's made in the past week, exaggerating an amount which need not to have been exaggerated. But my father has always felt that actualities somehow fall short. Suddenly, I begin to weep. The determined old lady who sits next to me in the theater is annoyed and looks at me with an angry face. And being intimidated, I stop. I drag out my handkerchief, I dry my face, licking the drop which has fallen near my lips. Meanwhile, I've missed something, for here are my mother and father alighting at the last stop, Coney Island. They walk toward the boardwalk, and my father commands my mother to inhale the pungent air from the sea. They both breathe in deeply, both of them laughing as they do so. They have in common a great interest in health. Although my father is strong and husky, my mother frail. Their minds are full of theories of what is good to eat and not good to eat. And sometimes they engage in heated discussions of the subject, the whole matter ending in my father's announcement made with a scornful bluster that you have to die sooner or later anyway. The boardwalk's flagpole, the American flag, is pulsing in an intermittent wind from the sea. My father and mother go to the rail of the boardwalk and they look down on the beach, where a good many bathers are casually walking about. A few are in the surf. A peanut whistle pierces the air with its pleasant and active whine, and my father goes to buy peanuts. My mother remains at the rail and stares at the ocean. The ocean seems merry to her. It pointedly sparkles, and again the pony waves are released. She notices the children digging in the wet sand and the bathing costumes of the girls who are her own age. My father returns with the peanuts. Overhead, the sun's lightning strikes and strikes, but neither of them are at all aware of it. The boardwalk is full of people dressed in their Sunday clothes and idly strolling. The tide does not reach as far as the boardwalk, and the strollers would feel no danger if it did. My mother and father lean on the rail of the boardwalk, and they absently stare at the ocean. The ocean is becoming rough, the waves coming in slowly, tugging strength from far back. The moment before they somersault, the moment when they arch their backs so beautifully, showing green and white veins amid the black, that moment is intolerable. They finally crack, dashing fiercely upon the sand, actually driving full force downward against the sand, bouncing upward and forward, and at last petering out into a small stream which races up the beach and then is recalled. My parents gaze absent-mindedly at the ocean, scarcely interested in its harshness. The sun overhead does not disturb them. But I stare at the terrible sun which breaks up sight and the fatal, merciless, passionate ocean. I forget my parents. I stare fascinated and finally shocked by the indifference of my father and mother. I burst out weeping once more. The old lady next to me pats me on the shoulder and says, "There, there, all of this is, it's only a movie, young man, only a movie." But I look up once more at the terrifying sun and the terrifying ocean, and being unable to control my tears, I get up and go to the men's room, stumbling over the feet of the other people seated in the row. When I return, feeling as if I had awakened in the morning, sick for lack of sleep, several hours have apparently passed, and my parents are riding on the merry-go-round. My father's on a black horse, my mother on a white one, and they seem to be making an eternal circuit for the single purpose of snatching the nickel rings which are attached to the arm of one of the posts. A hand organ is playing. It is one with the ceaseless circling of the merry-go-round. For a moment it seems they'll never get off the merry-go-round because it will never stop. I feel like one who looks down on the avenue from the 50th story of a building, but at length they do get off. Even the music of the hand organ has ceased for a moment. My father has acquired 10 rings, my mother only 2, although it was my mother who really wanted them. They walk on along the boardwalk as the afternoon descends by imperceptible degrees into the incredible violet of dusk. Everything fades into a relaxed glow, even the ceaseless murmuring from the beach and the revolutions of the merry-go-round. They look for a place to have dinner. My father suggests the best one on the boardwalk, and my mother demurs in accordance with her principles. However, they do go to the best place, asking for a table near the window so they can look out on the boardwalk and the mobile ocean. My father feels omnipotent as he places a quarter in the waiter's hand as he asks for a table. The place is crowded, and here, too, there's music, this time from a kind of string trio. My father orders dinner with a fine confidence. As the dinner is eaten, my father tells of his plans for the future, and my mother shows with expressive face how interested she is and how impressed. My father becomes exultant. He is lifted up by the waltz that is being played, and his own future begins to intoxicate him. My father tells my mother he's going to expand his business, for there's a great deal of money to be made. He wants to settle down. After all, he is 29. He's lived by himself since he was 13. He's making more and more money. And he's envious of his married friends when he visits them in the cozy security of their homes, surrounded, it seems, by the calm domestic pleasures and by delightful children. And then as the waltz reaches the moment when all the dancers swing madly, then with awful daring, he asks my mother to marry him, although awkwardly enough and puzzled even at his excitement at how he had arrived at the proposal. And she, to make the whole business worse, begins to cry, and my father looks nervously about, not knowing at all what to do now, and my mother says, "It's all I've wanted from the moment I saw you," sobbing. And he finds all of this very difficult, scarcely to his taste, scarcely as he had thought it would be on his long walks over Brooklyn Bridge in the reverie of a fine cigar, and it was then that I stood up in the theater and shouted, "Don't do it!" "It's not too late to change your minds, both of you. Nothing good will come of it. Only remorse, hatred, scandal, and 2 children whose characters are monstrous." The whole audience turned to look at me. Annoyed, the usher came hurrying down the aisle, flashing his searchlight, and the old lady next to me tugged me down into my seat, saying, "Be quiet, you'll be put out. And you paid 35 cents to come in." And so I shut my eyes because I could not bear to see what was happening. I sat there quietly. But after a while, I begin to take brief glimpses, and at length, I watch again with thirsty interest, like a child who wants to maintain his sulk, although offered the bribe of candy. My parents are now having their picture taken in a photographer's booth along the boardwalk. The place is shadowed in the mauve light, which is apparently necessary. The camera is set to the side on its tripod and looks like a Martian man. The photographer is instructing my parents in how to pose. My father has his arm over my mother's shoulder, and both of them smile emphatically. The photographer brings my mother a bouquet of flowers to hold in her hand, but she holds it at the wrong angle. And then the photographer covers himself with a black cloth, which drapes the camera, and all that one sees of him is one protruding arm and his hand, which clutches the rubber ball, which he will squeeze when the picture is finally taken. But he's not satisfied with their appearance. He feels with certainty that somehow there's something wrong in their pose. Again and again he issues from his hidden place with new directions. Each suggestion merely makes matters worse. My father's becoming impatient. They try a seated pose. The photographer explains that he has pride. He's not interested in all of this for the money. He wants to make beautiful pictures. My father says, "Hurry up, will you? We haven't got all night." but the photographer only scurries about apologetically and issues new directions. The photographer charms me. I approve of him with all my heart, for I know just how he feels. And as he criticizes each revised pose according to some unknown idea of rightness, I become quite hopeful. But then my father says angrily, "Come on! You've had enough time. We're not going to wait any longer." And the photographer, sighing unhappily, goes back under his black covering, holds out his hand, says, "One, two, three, now," and the picture is taken. With my father's smile turned to a grimace, and my mother's bright and false. It takes a few minutes for the picture to be developed, and as my parents sit in the curious light, they become quite depressed. They've passed the fortune teller's booth, and my mother wishes to go in, but my father does not. They begin to argue about it. My mother becomes stubborn, my father once more impatient, and then they begin to quarrel. And what my father would like to do is walk off and leave my mother there, but he knows that that would never do. My mother refuses to budge. She's near to tears, but she feels an uncontrollable desire to hear what the palm reader will say. My father consents angrily, and they both go into a booth which is in a way like the photographer's, since it is draped in black cloth and its light is shadowed. The place is too warm. And my father keeps saying this is all nonsense, pointing to the crystal ball on the table, the fortune teller, a fat, short woman garbed in what is supposed to be oriental robes, comes into the room from the back and greets them, speaking with an accent. But suddenly my father feels that the whole thing is intolerable. He tugs at my mother's arm, but my mother refuses to budge. And then in terrible anger, my father lets go of my mother's arm and strides out, leaving my mother stunned. She moves to go after my father, but the fortune teller holds her arm tightly and begs her not to do so. And I, in my seat, am shocked more than can ever be said, for I feel as if I'm walking a tightrope 100 feet above a circus audience, and suddenly the rope is showing signs of breaking. And I get up from my seat and I begin to shout once more the first words I can think to communicate my terrible fear, and once more the usher comes hurrying down the aisle, flashing his searchlight, and the old lady pleads with me, and the shocked audience has turned to stare at me, and I keep shouting, "What are they doing? Don't they know what they're doing? Why doesn't my mother go after my father? If she does not do that, what will she do? Doesn't my father know what he's doing?" But the usher has seized my arm and is dragging me away, and as he does so, he says, "What are you doing? Don't you know that you can't do whatever you want to do? Why should a young man like you with your whole life before you get hysterical like this? Why don't you think of what you're doing? You can't act like this even if other people aren't around. You will be sorry if you don't do what you should do. You can't carry on like this. It's not right. You'll find that out soon enough. Everything you do matters too much." And he said that, dragging me through the lobby of the theater into the cold light. And I woke up into the bleak winter morning of my 21st birthday, the windowsill shining with its lip of snow, and the morning already begun.
Leonard Nimoy performed In Dreams Begin Responsibilities by Delmore Schwartz. I'm Jane Curtin. When we return, another family story from Tess Gallagher. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at zabars.com/shorts. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Jane Curtin. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. Our second story on this program about family legacy is Tess Gallagher's beautiful The Lover of Horses. It was also read at the Getty Center in Los Angeles by Kate Burton. Burton's many credits include her critically acclaimed performance in Ibsen's Hedda Gabler and roles in the television series Grey's Anatomy and Scandal.
They say my great-grandfather was a gypsy, but the most popular explanation for his behavior was that he was a drunk. How else could the women have kept up the scourge of his memory all these years had they not had the usual malady of our family to blame? Probably he was both a gypsy and a drunk. Still, I have reason to believe the gypsy in him had more to do with the turn his life took than his drinking. I used to argue with my mother about this, even though most of the information I have about my great-grandfather came from my mother, who got it from her mother. A drunk, I kept telling her, would have had no initiative. He would simply have gone down with his failures and had nothing to show for it. But my great-grandfather had 11 children, surely a sign of industry. And he was a lover of horses. He had so many horses, he was what people called horse poor. I did not learn until I traveled to where my family originated at Cullenamore in the west of Ireland that my great-great-grandfather had most likely been a whisperer, a breed of men among the gypsies who were said to possess the power of talking sense into horses. These men had no fear of even the most malicious and dangerous horses. In fact, they would often take the wild animal into a closed stall in order to perform their skills. Whether a certain intimacy was needed or whether the whisperers simply wanted to protect their secret conversations with horses is not known. One thing was certain, that such men gained power over horses by whispering. What they whispered, no one knew. But the effectiveness of their methods was renowned, and anyone for counties around who had an unruly horse could send for a whisperer and be sure that the horse would take to heart whatever was said and reform his behavior from that day forth. By all accounts, my great-grandfather was like a huge stallion himself, and when he went into a field where a herd of horses was grazing, the horses would suddenly lift their heads and call to him. Then his bearded mouth would move, and though he was making sounds that could have been words which no horse would have had reason to understand, the horses would want to hear, and one by one they would move toward him across the open space of the field. He could turn his back and walk down the road, and they would follow him. He was probably drunk, my mother said, because he was swaying and mumbling all the while. Sometimes he would stop dead still in the road, and the horses would press up against him and raise and lower their heads as he moved his lips. But because these things were only seen from a distance, and because they have eroded in the telling, it is now impossible to know whether my great-grandfather said anything of importance to the horses, or even if it was his whispering that had brought about their good behavior. Nor was it clear when he left them in some barnyard as suddenly as he'd come to them whether they had arrived at some new understanding of the difficult and complex relationship between men and horses. Only the aberrations of my great-grandfather's relationship with horses have survived, as when he would bathe in the river with his favorite horse, or when, as my grandmother told my mother, he insisted on conceiving his ninth child in the stall of a bay mare named Redwing. Not until I was grown and going through the family Bible did I discover that my grandmother had been this ninth child, and so must have known something about the matter. These oddities in behavior lead me to believe that when my great-grandfather, at the age of 52, abandoned his wife and family to join a circus that was passing through this area, it was not simply drunken bravado, nor even the understandable wish to escape family obligations. I believe the gypsy in him finally got the upper hand. And it led to such a remarkable happening that no one in the family has so far been willing to admit it. Not the obvious transgression that he had run away to join the circus, but that he was in all likelihood a man who had been stolen by a horse. This is not an easy view to sustain in the society we live in. But I have not come to it frivolously and have some basis for my belief. For although I have heard the story of my great-grandfather's defection time and again since childhood, the one image which prevails in all versions is that of a dappled gray stallion that had been trained to dance a variation of the mazurka. So impressive was this animal that he mesmerized crowds with his sliding step and hop to the side through the complicated figures of the dance, which he performed not in the way of the Lipizzaners with other horses and their riders, but riderless and with the men of the circus company as his partners. It is known that my great-grandfather became one of these dancers. After that, he was reputed, in my mother's words, to have gone completely to ruin. The fact that he walked from the horse with only the clothes on his back, leaving behind his own beloved horses, 29 of them to be exact, further supports my idea that a powerful force must have held sway over him, something more profound than the miseries of drink or the harsh imaginings of his abandoned wife. Not even the fact that 7 years later he returned and knocked on his wife's door, asking to be taken back, could exonerate him from what he had done, even though his wife did take him in and looked after him until he died some years later. But the detail that no one takes note of in the account is that when my great-grandfather returned, he was carrying a saddle blanket and the black plumes from the headgear of one of the circus horses. This passes by even my mother is simply a sign of the ridiculousness of my great-grandfather's plight, for after all, he was homeless and heading for old age as a good-for-nothing drunk and a fool for horses. No one has bothered to conjecture what this curious emblems, saddle blanket and plumes, must have meant to my great-grandfather, but he hung them over the foot of his bed like a fool, my mother said. And sometimes when he got very drunk, he would take up the blanket and, wrapping it like a shawl over his shoulders, he would grasp the plumes. Then he would dance the mazurka. He did not dance in the living room, but took himself out into the field, where the horses stood at attention and watched as if suddenly experiencing the smell of the sea or change of wind in the valley. "Drunks don't care what they do," my mother would say as she finished her story about my great-grandfather. "Talking to a drunk is like talking to a stump." Ever since my great-grandfather's outbreaks of gypsy necessity, members of my family have been stolen by things, by mad ambitions, by musical instruments, by otherwise harmless pursuits from mushroom hunting to childbearing, or, as was my father's case, by the more easily recognized and popular obsession with card playing. To some extent, I still think it was failure of imagination in this respect that brought about his diminished prospects in the life of our family. But even my mother had been powerless against the attraction of a man so convincingly driven. When she met him at a birthday dance held at the country house of one of her young friends, she asked him what he did for a living. My father pointed to a deck of cards in his shirt pocket and said, "I play cards." But love is such as it is, and although my mother was otherwise a deadly practical woman, it seemed she could fall in love with no man but my father. So it is possible that a propensity to be stolen is somewhat contagious when ordinary people come into contact with people such as my father. Though my mother loved him at the time of the marriage, she soon began to behave as if she had been stolen from a more fruitful and upright life, which she was always imagining might have been hers. My father's card playing was accompanied, to no one's surprise, by bouts of drinking. The only thing that may have saved our family from a life of poverty was the fact that my father seldom gambled with money. Such were his charm and powers of persuasion that he was able to convince other players to accept his notes on everything from the fish he intended to catch next season to the sale of his daughter's hair. I know about this last wager because I remember the day he came to me with a pair of scissors and said it was time to cut my hair. Two snips, and it was done. I cannot forget the way he wept onto the back of his hands and held the braids together like a broken noose from which a life had suddenly slipped. I was 13 at the time, and my hair had never been cut. It was his pride and joy that I had such hair. But for me, it was only a burdensome difference between me and my classmates, so I was glad to be rid of it. What anyone else could have wanted with my long, shiny braids is still a mystery to me. When my father was 73, he fell ill, and the doctors gave him only a few weeks to live. My father was convinced that his illness had come on him because he'd hit a particularly bad losing streak at cards. He had lost heavily the previous month, and items of value, mostly belonging to my mother, had disappeared from the house. He developed the strange idea that if he could win at cards, he could cheat the prediction of the doctors and live at least into his 80s. By this time, I had moved away from home and made a life for myself in an attempt to follow the reasonable dictates of my mother, who had counseled her children severely against all manner of rash ambition and foolhardiness. Her entreaties were leveled especially in my direction, since I had shown a suspect enthusiasm for a certain pony at around the age of 5. And it is true I felt I had lost a dear friend when my mother saw to it that the neighbors who owned this pony moved it to pasture elsewhere. But there were other signs that I might wander off into unpredictable pursuits. The most telling of these was that I refused to speak aloud to anyone until the age of 11. I whispered everything, as if my mind were a repository of secrets which could only be divulged in this intimate manner. If anyone asked me a question, I was always polite about answering, but I had to do it by putting my mouth near the head of my inquisitor and using only my breath and lips to make my reply. My teachers put my whispering down to shyness and made special accommodations for me. When it came time for recitations, I would accompany the teacher into the cloakroom and there whisper to her the memorized verses or the speech I was to have prepared. God knows I might have continued on like this into the present if my mother hadn't plotted with some neighborhood boys to put burrs into my long hair. She knew by other signs that I had a terrible temper, and she was counting on that to deliver me into the world where people shouted and railed at one another and talked in an audible fashion about things both common and sacred. When the boys shut me into a shed, according to plan, there was nothing for me to do but to cry out for help and to curse them in a torrent of words I had only heard used by adults. When my mother heard this, she rejoiced, thinking that at last she had broken the treacherous hold of the past over me, of my great-grandfather's gypsy blood, and the fear that against all her efforts I might be stolen away, as she had been, and as my father had, by some as yet unforeseen predilection. Had I not already experienced the consequences of such a life in our household, I doubt she would have been successful, but the advantages of an ordinary existence among people of a less volatile nature had begun to appeal to me. It was strange, then, that after all the care my mother had taken for me in this regard, when my father's illness came on him, my mother brought her appeal to me. "Can you do something?" she wrote in her cramped left-handed scrawl. "He's been drinking and playing cards for 3 days and night. I'm at my wit's end. Come home at once." Somehow I knew this was a message addressed to the very part of me that most baffled and frightened my mother, the part that belonged exclusively to my father and his family's inexplicable manias. When I arrived home, my father was not there. "He's at the tavern in the back room," my mother said. "He hasn't eaten for days, and if he slept, he hasn't done it here." I made up a strong broth, and as I poured the steaming liquid into a thermos, I heard myself utter syllables and other vestiges of language which I could not reproduce if I wanted to. "What do you mean by that?" my mother demanded, as if a demon had leapt out of me. "What did you say?" "I didn't. I couldn't answer her." But suddenly I felt that an unsuspected network of sympathies and distant connections had begun to reveal itself to me in my father's behalf. There is a saying that when lovers have need of moonlight, it is there. So it seemed as I made my way through the deserted town toward the tavern and card room that all nature had been given notice of my father's predicament and that the response I was waiting for would not be far off. But when I arrived at the tavern and had talked my way past the barman and into the card room itself, I saw that my father had an enormous pile of blue chips at his elbow. Several players had fallen out to watch, heavy-lidded and smoking their cigarettes like weary gangsters. Others were slumped on folding chairs near the coffee urn with its empty "pay here" styrofoam cup. My father's cap was pushed to the back of his head so that his forehead shone in the dim light, and he grinned over his cigarette at me with the serious preoccupation of a child who has no intention of obeying anyone. And why should he? I thought as I sat down just beside him and loosened the stopper on the thermos. The five or six players still at the table casually appraised my presence to see if it had tipped the scales of their luck in an even more unfavorable direction. Then they tossed their cards aside, drew fresh cards, or folded. In the center of the table were more blue chips, and poking out from my father's coat pocket, I recognized the promissory slips he must have redeemed, for he leaned to me and in a low voice, without taking his eyes from his cards, said, "I'm having a hell of a good time. The time of my life." He was winning. His face seemed ravaged by the effort, but he was clearly playing on a level that had carried the game far beyond the realm of mere card playing, and everyone seemed to know it. The dealer cocked an eyebrow as I poured broth into the plastic thermos cup and handed it to my father, who slurped from it noisily, then set it down. "Tell the old kettle she's got to put up with me a few more years," he said, and lit up a fresh cigarette. His eyes, as he looked at me, however, seemed over-brilliant, as if doubt, despite all his efforts, had gained a permanent seat at his table. I squeezed his shoulder and kissed him hurriedly on his forehead. The men kept their eyes down, and as I paused at the door, there was a shifting of chairs and a clearing of throats. Just outside the room, I nearly collided with the barman, who was carrying in a fresh round of beer. His heavy jowls waggled as he recovered himself and looked hard at me over the icy bottles. Then he disappeared into the card room with his provisions. I took the long way home, finding pleasure in the fact that at this hour all the stoplights had switched onto a flashing yellow caution cycle. Even the teenagers who usually cruised the town had gone home to more secluded spots. Doubt, I kept thinking as I drove with my father's face before me. That's the real thief. And I knew my mother had brought me home because of it, because she knew that once again a member of our family was about to be stolen. 2 more days and nights I ministered to my father at the card room. I would never stay long because I had the fear myself that I might spoil his luck. But many unspoken tendernesses passed between us in those brief appearances as he accepted the nourishment I offered, or when he looked up and handed me his beer bottle to take a swig from. A ritual we'd shared since my childhood. My father continued to win, to the amazement of the local barflies, who poked their faces in and out of the card room and gave the dwindling 3 or 4 stalwarts who remained at the table a commiserating shake of their heads. There had never been a winning streak like it in the history of the tavern, and indeed, we heard later that the man who owned the card room and tavern had to sell out and open a fruit stand on the edge of town as a result of my father's extraordinary good luck. Twice during this period, my mother urged the doctor to order my father home. She was sure my father would, at some fateful moment, risk the entire winnings in some mad rush toward oblivion. But his doctor spoke of a new gaming therapy for the terminally ill, based on my father's surge of energies in the pursuit of his gambling. Little did he know that my father was, by that stage, oblivious to even his winning. He had gone so far into exhaustion. Luckily for my father, the hour came when, for lack of players, the game folded. 2 old friends drove him home and helped him down from the pickup. They paused in the driveway, one on either side of him, letting him steady himself. When the card playing had ended, there had been nothing for my father to do but to get drunk. My mother and I watched from the window as the men steered my father toward the hydrangea bush at the side of the house, where he relieved himself with perfect precision on 1 mammoth blossom. Then they hoisted him up the stairs and into the entryway. My mother and I took over from there. "Give 'em hell, boys," my father shouted after the men, concluding some conversation he was having with himself. "You betcha," the driver called back, laughing. Then he climbed with his companion into the cab of his truck and roared away. Tied around my father's waist was a cloth sack full of bills and coins, which flapped and jingled against his knees as we bore his weight between us up the next flight of stairs and into the living room. There we deposited him on the couch where he took up residence, refusing to sleep in his bed for fear, my mother claimed, that death would know where to find him. But I prefer to think he enjoyed the rhythms of the household. From where he lay at the center of the house, he could overhear all conversations that took place and add his opinions when he felt like it. My mother was so stricken by the signs of his further decline that she did everything he asked instead of arguing with him or simply refusing. Instead of taking his winnings straight to the bank so as not to miss a day's interest, she washed an old goldfish bowl and dumped all the money into it, most of it in $20 bills. Then she placed it on the coffee table near his head so he could run his hands through it at will, or let his visitors do the same. "Money feels good on your elbow," he would say to them. "I played them under the table for that. Yes, sir, take a feel of that." Then he would lean back on his pillows and tell my mother to bring his guests a shot of whiskey. "Make sure she fills my glass up," he'd say to me so that my mother was certain to overhear. And my mother, who'd never allowed a bottle of whiskey to be brought into her house before now, would look at me as if the two of us were more than any woman should have to bear. "If only you'd brought him home from that card room," she said again and again, "maybe it wouldn't have come to this." This included the fact that my father had radically altered his diet. He lived only on greens. If it was green, he would eat it. By my mother's reckoning, the reason for his change of diet was that if he stopped eating what he usually ate, death would think it wasn't him and go look for somebody else. Another request my father made was asking my mother to sweep the doorway after anyone came in or went out. To make sure death wasn't on their heels, to make sure death didn't slip in as they left. This was my mother's reasoning. But my father didn't give any reasons, nor did he tell us finally why he wanted all the furniture moved out of the room except for the couch where he lay. And the money, they could take that away too. But soon his strength began to ebb, and more family and friends crowded into the vacant room to pass the time with him, to laugh about stories remembered from his childhood or from his nights as a young man at the country dances when he and his older brother would work all day in the cotton fields, hop a freight train to town, and dance all night. Then they would have to walk home, getting there just at daybreak in time to go straight to work again in the cotton fields. "We were like bulls then," my father would say in a burst of the old vigor, then close his eyes suddenly as if he hadn't said anything at all. As long as he spoke to us, the inevitability of his condition seemed easier to bear. But when, at the last, he simply opened his mouth for food or stared silently toward the far wall, no one knew what to do with themselves. My own part in that uncertain time came to me accidentally. I found myself in the yard, sitting on a stone bench under a little cedar tree my father loved because he liked to sit there and stare at the ocean. "The tree whispered," he said. He said it had a way of knowing what your troubles were. Suddenly, a craving came over me. I wanted a cigarette, even though I don't smoke, hate smoking, in fact. I was sitting where my father had sat, and to smoke seemed a part of some rightness that had begun to work its way within me. I went into the house and bummed a pack of cigarettes for my brother. For the rest of the morning, I sat under the cedar tree and smoked. My thoughts drifted with its shiftings and murmurings, and it struck me what a wonderful thing nature is because it knows the value of silence, the innuendos of silence, and what they could mean for a word-bound creature such as I was. I passed the rest of the day in a trance of silences, moving from place to place, revisiting the sights I knew my father loved. The dragon tree, a hemlock which stood at the far end of the orchard, so named for how the wind tossed its triangular head. The rose arbor where he and my mother had courted. The little marina where I sat in his fishing boat and dutifully smoked the hated cigarettes, flinging them one by one into the brackish water. I was waiting to know what to do for him. He who would soon be a piece of useless matter of no more consequence than the cigarette butts that floated and washed against the side of his boat. I could feel some action accumulating in me through the steadiness of water raising and lowering the boat, through the sad petal fall of roses in the arbor and the tossing of the dragon tree. That night, when I walked from the house, I was full of purpose. I headed toward the little cedar tree. Without stopping to question the necessity of what I was doing, I began to break off the boughs I could reach and to pile them on the ground. "What are you doing?" my brother's children wanted to know. crowding around me as if I might be inventing some new game for them. "What does it look like?" I said. "Pulling limbs off the tree," the oldest said. Then they dashed away in a pack under the orchard trees, giggling and shrieking. As I pulled the boughs from the trunk, I felt a painful permission, as when two silences, tired of holding back, give over to each other some shared regret. I made my bed on the boughs and resolved to spend the night there in the yard under the stars with the hiss of the ocean in my ear and the maimed cedar tree standing over me like a gift torn out of its wrappings. My brothers, their wives, and my sister had now begun their nightly vigil near my father, taking turns at staying awake. The windows were open for the breeze, and I heard my mother trying to answer the question of why I was sleeping outside on the ground. "Like a damned fool," I knew they wanted to add. "She doesn't want to be here when death comes for him," my mother said with an air of clairvoyance she had developed from a lifetime with my father. "They're too much alike," she said. The ritual of night games played by the children went on and on long past their bedtimes. Inside the house, the kerosene lantern, saved from my father's childhood home, had been lit, another of his strange requests during the time before his silence. He liked the shadows it made and the sweet smell of the kerosene. I watched the darkness as the shapes of my brothers and sister passed near it, gigantic and misshapen, where they bent or raised themselves or crossed the room. Out on the water, the wind had come up. In the orchard, the children were spinning around in a circle, faster and faster, until they were giddy and reeling with speed and darkness. Then they would stop, rest a moment, taking quick, ecstatic breaths before plunging again into the opposite direction, swirling round and round in the circle until the excitement could rise no higher, their laughter and cries brimming over, then scattering as they flung one another by the arms or chased each other toward the houses as if their life depended on it. I lay awake for a long time after their footsteps had died and the car doors had slammed over the goodbyes of the children being taken home to bed and the last of the others had been bedded down in the house while the adults went on waiting. It was important to be out there alone and close to the ground. The pungent smell of the cedar boughs was around me, rising up in the crisp night air toward the tree, whose turnings and swayings had altered as they had to in order to accompany the changes about to overtake my father and me. I thought of my great-grandfather bathing with his horse in the river, and of my father who had just passed through the longest period in his life without the clean feel of cards falling through his hands as he shuffled or dealt them. He was too weak now even to hold a cigarette. There was a burn mark on the hardwood floor where his last cigarette had fallen. His winnings were safely in the bank, and the luck that was to have saved him had gone back to that place luck goes to when it is finished with us. So this is what it comes to, I thought, and listened to the wind as it mixed gradually with the memory of children's voices which still seemed to rise and fall in the orchard. There was a soft crooning of syllables that was satisfying to my ears, but ultimately useless and absurd. Then it came to me that I was the author of those unwieldy sounds, and that my lips had begun to work of themselves. In a raw pulsing of language I could not account for, I lay awake through the long night and spoke to my father as one might speak to an ocean or the wind, letting him know by that threadbare accompaniment that the vastness he was about to enter had its rhythms in me also, and that he was not forsaken, and that I was letting him go. That so far I had denied the disreputable world of dancers and drunkards, gamblers and lovers of horses to which I most surely belonged. But from that night forward, I vowed to be filled with the first unsavory desire that would have me, to plunge myself into the heart of my life and be ruthlessly lost forever.
Kate Burton performed Tess Gallagher's The Lover of Horses. I'm Jane Curtin, and I'm here in the studio with Selected Shorts literary commentator Hannah Tinty. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Jane. The Lover of Horses is written by Tess Gallagher, and she's very well known for being the wife of Raymond Carver, and she's done so much to protect his estate and have his work reprinted in various ways. But she's a wonderful writer in her own right, both poetry and fiction and nonfiction, and I'm thrilled to have a story of hers on this program. And The Lover of Horses just, it strikes such an interesting chord, this idea of being stolen by something.
I loved it. I loved the metaphor of it. I loved the fact that they had to surrender to this. It wasn't anything they chose. It was something that they were. His ability to communicate with horses was something that, you know, he wasn't a great man, but he had a gift.
I love the mother of the narrator keeps saying, oh, they were just drunks.
I know. And he's worthless, and yet he has this gift that just serves him so well. And that's the grandfather and the father having this problem, which is the same thing as the gift of talking to horses. And then the daughter realizing she has to surrender to something as well. It's in her DNA. You know, she is not fully formed until she is kidnapped by an idea.
And at the end, when she sort of separates from the family the same way the two men also separated from their families, and she's talking to the trees, I couldn't help but feel it for her. You know, the thing that was stealing her was telling us this story.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the writing is the thing that was stealing her.
And so for her, it was separating from the strictness of the mother and the sort of the staunch reality of the mother and the fact that she could go outside of that reality, which was cold and it was hard and it was judgmental, and to go into a place where dreams happen and where you can be swept away by an idea.
There's a line in the story that I think really sums up what you're saying right here, and it's, she says, ever since my great-grandfather's outbreaks of gypsy necessity, members of my family have been stolen by things, by mad ambitions, by musical instruments, by otherwise harmless pursuits, from mushroom hunting to childbearing. It's whatever sort of captures your soul and makes, I think, sort of living important for you.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jane Curtin. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Perotta. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the short story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust's Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI Public Radio International.
PRI Public Radio International.